So taking a permit set where the windows are all the same size, everything is the same size in makeup, it's just on a different lot. That way, we have the option to do bulk buying. So bulk buying is going to give us a couple different options. It's going to allow us to control our own supply chain a little bit better because we can actually bulk buy and hold materials in a warehouse, as well as obviously better pricing.
What's going on, guys? This is the Passive Wealth Strategy Show, the show that will help you escape the Wall Street casino and build wealth on Main Street by investing in real estate. Today, our guest is Carl Krauskopf, and today we're talking about ground-up development of townhouses. This is one of the strategies that Carl uses to invest in real estate, and we're digging into the full process here, from getting it started to all the way to finishing up and selling it off, or other strategies to exit a townhouse development. Really interesting stuff. We go through the whole process, the entire process, the way his company does it, and dig into a number of aspects within that process as well. And if you're considering investing in a development, no matter how your strategy of investing in it might be, it's good to know the process, right? It's good to know how it works, how a successful development looks. And that's what we're digging into today. A lot of great information in this one. You're going to learn so much. I'm your host, Taylor Lote. I'm a real estate investor, and I help busy people passively invest in commercial real estate, specifically in apartment building and self-storage syndications. If you're interested in learning more and potentially investing with us on a future deal, just go to investwithtaylor.com, fill out the form, and schedule a call with me. I will look forward to speaking with you then. If you're an Apple Podcast user and you enjoy the show, please do take a moment and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars if you don't mind, guys. I appreciate that so, so much. That helps other people learn about the show because that helps us rank higher in the Apple Podcast ecosystem. And I'm always honest with you guys. That gives me a nice little warm and fuzzy feeling because I get to see that you're engaging with the content and you're escaping the Wall Street casino along with us. If you know anyone who could use a little bit more passive wealth in their lives, please share the show with them and bring them into the tribe. If you haven't done so yet, don't forget to subscribe. Look us up on your favorite podcast app. So hit that subscribe button. That way you'll get every new episode every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. Once again, our guest today is Carl Krauskopf, and today we're digging into ground-up development of townhouses. Really interesting stuff. Without any further ado, here we go. Carl, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Going to have a lot of great information for our listeners today. For those out there who don't know about you and your business, can you tell us about your background and what you invest in?
Sure. So my name is Carl Krauskopf. I live up in Seattle, Washington. And Aurora's investment group right now is primarily focused on two different products. One is the townhome and apartment development. So think of ground up construction, where we have options to buy, build, and sell, or buy, build, and rent, and hold long term on those, either the townhome or the apartments. And then the other would be the kind of the traditional value add apartments. On the latter side, we're really focused on Sunbelt, steady appreciation, steady cash flow. On the former, we're really focused on higher appreciation markets like the Northwest and some of the other markets that are really again focused on appreciation.
Great, and you know. I want to continue on the conversation really that we were having before we were hit recording and really dig into townhome development, your experiences there, lessons learned, and you know, all of those kinds of things. So at a high level, can you get us started and tell us about, you know, the types of deals that you do in townhome development?
Sure. So really, again, a lot of our experiences up here in Seattle, where you know, I'm sure most other markets have a lot of bureaucracy and timing in terms of getting entitlements, permitting. And I would say the average up here for a very low ambitious, meaning you're not pushing envelopes, you're not getting variations in codes or zoning, is about 12 months. So 12 months to get titled entitlements, to get permits. And then you're looking at an additional 12 months plus to get the construction and getting onto whatever your next phase is, whether it's whether it's holding or selling. So right now we are hyper-focused, laser-focused, I would say, on buying straight from developers the already entitled and permit-ready projects. So that way we can bypass that phase. Obviously, we're going to be leaving a little bit on the table in terms of you know, those developers obviously have to make some money on their side of the house, but it's reducing our exposure to market cycles, long market cycles, by being able to get in and get out onto our next strategy within typically, again, between 10 and 14 months.
Okay, great. So let's dig into that and how you find those developers and figure out who to work with and what your, you know, screening process. I'm sure you have some kind of process there on the front end to figure out, you know, what lots to buy, what to invest in, what, you know, where's a good opportunity. So at a high level, how do you get started in picking a developer, picking lots, and all of that right on the front end?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the developers, you know, what we've got in Seattle is a couple different things that's helpful for identifying those developers. There's a website out there that shows from a user-friendly perspective where all of the permit approved and the in-permit process projects are in the Seattle area. Now, I know some of the other cities around it do not necessarily have that, which makes it a little bit more difficult. But in Seattle, what we do, we start off with making and building those relationships based on that user interface, reach out, email, get to know them, and start talking to them about their projects. 9 times out of 10, our purchase price does not meet whatever their sale price is. Absolutely, right? They want more, we can't afford more. And so we part ways on that particular project. But in the 1 in 10 cases where it does work, we get it under contract, do some additional due diligence, and either continue on and close, or for whatever reason, we may have to back out. Now, you mentioned something about due diligence earlier is, you know, I think one of the things as we continue to evolve and grow as a company is continuing to move that due diligence upstream. So that way we're able to ask some of the most pertinent questions to qualify these leads in advance of going under contract. So that way we're not spending unnecessary time either on our side, the developer side, or sometimes if there's a broker involved on their side as well. So we built out and we're continuing to build out that due diligence checklist. And it really aims at identifying long-term construction requirements, high-cost construction requirements. Two of the biggest examples there are street improvement plans and any kind of utility enhancements. So street improvement plans are where we're extending typically some kind of utility like a water main, a sewer, or even if it's just increasing the size of the road, doing curb cuts, that kind of stuff. And the difficult part with that is we're working with every single municipality in the city, right? From your Department of Transportation to fire to all of the utilities to the so forth and so on. So really exposes us even more so into those long market cycles. So we try and really focus on projects that don't have that type of work. So that way, again, we can hit our business strategy of getting in, getting out, getting onto strategy B in that 10 to 14 months.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier on about when you're looking at these deals, say 9 out of 10 don't end up panning out because, the developer that wants more money for the lot than you are going to pay. And that's totally fine. For those types of deals, is that typically because are they, you know, unreasonable, or are those lots going to maybe a more retail type of person who's just going to build a house for themselves to live in it? Or what's the typical reason for the disconnect there in your experience?
So there's a couple of reasons. I would say on the conservative side, you know, when we bank and when we underwrite our exit value, whether it's on the rental side or on the sale side, we don't bank or we don't underwrite appreciation into our sales and into our projects. Now that ends up leaving us this 9 to 10 deals that don't actually pan out. But I feel, again, in the stage that we're at as a company, that I don't want to take on that risk. Because again, sure, we've seen crazy spikes in appreciation over this last year. Sure, we could even underwrite a standard normal appreciation, but for the time being, we continue to operate in looking at whatever our exit values are based on today's comparable either sales or, you know, when we're underwriting long-term holds, you know, we're still doing cap rate regression analysis. So, you know, we're adding on 15 basis points for every quarter that we're exposed to the market. So that way, again, we're underwriting with conservative metrics and on a conservative basis. So I think that typically that's, you know, that's why we've heard a lot of, well, what's your you know, estimated cost to sell, or what's your rental base? And we go through that, and it's usually a strong disconnect between what we're underwriting and what the developer is going to be underwriting.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. So now let's get back to the process. We kind of left it off, or we kind of, maybe I diverted us a little bit. After you get a piece of property under contract, you start doing your due diligence. Let's get back on track there till we, you know, I want to end up basically with a finished property that you're looking to, you know, move on from. So once you have the property under contract, you start your due diligence. Let's pick it up there. What's the next step?
Yeah. So really on the due diligence side, you know, we've got a strong sense, especially with our, you know, our background in construction and our partners from a fee builder, or rather a fee developer standpoint, right? We're partnering with developers that have been doing, building these townhomes for 20, 30 years, right? So, you know, we're confident in our ability to work with and perform based on their ability to continue to put up structures as they have the past 20 to 30 years. And so we've got a strong sense of a cost of construction. So it's, you know, the biggest part once we get under contract is just that is two parts. A validating cost of construction, right? On the initial underwriting, we're assuming, you know, what we've seen maybe with some cost inflation added to it. And then, that's been a fun and wild ride this last year. And it continues to be. Lumber has been going back up, which has been painful.
Yep.
But the next phase of the feasibility is generally speaking our capital raising side, where, you know, we work with our limited partners, limited investors on raising the necessary equity to close on the property.
Okay, great. And that material cost inflation has been obviously really big, and there's the cost inflation, also the availability, and then of course labor and all these other things that factor into it. How do you deal with all of that variability in terms of, you know, in a nuts and bolts sense? I mean, how do you kind of make sense of it? Because that has definitely been a stumbling block for many developers out there.
Yeah. And it continues to be, especially on, so I'll take those three verticals, right? Cost of materials, availability of materials, and cost of labor. So on the first side, the cost of materials, you know, I saw an interesting, I had an interesting presentation this last week where a developer who's putting up 3,000 units across the country a year, he did an incredibly thorough analysis showing that a lot of the cost of material is actually a cost. It's a function of cost of shipping. So as opposed to the true actual cost of the material, the cost of shipping is the one that's driving the sheer increase. And so, you know, I don't see that getting much better over the very, very short term. I do absolutely see it getting better by the end of this year, state and country lines become a little bit less restrictive. I do believe that those prices will come down. However, we do have a terrible humanitarian crisis that's happening right now that, you know, could to some degree and will to some degree impact cost of gasoline, oil, et cetera, that will, for the short term, I hope, impact the cost of materials, albeit through the cost of shipping. Delay of materials, I mean, it's a real thing, right? Our most recent development, we had window delivery scheduled for 6 weeks, and we just literally got it yesterday at the 13th week.
Oh, man.
So how do you manage that, right? It's difficult. So there's a couple ways that we're considering in the future, going forward in the future, is working with a permit set that is identical from one project to another. So taking a permit set where the windows are all the same size, everything is the same size in makeup, it's just on a different lot. That way, we have the option to do bulk buying. So bulk buying is going to give us a couple different options. It's going to allow us to control our own supply chain a little bit better, because we can actually bulk buy and hold materials in a warehouse, as well as obviously better pricing. And so, you know, I think that that's, you know, that's an opportunity that we're going to have over the coming, and that we're going to take over the coming 2022, just to, again, give us better control over our own supply chain, as well as help reduce costs as, you know, costs elsewhere continue to go up. And then on the labor side, labor shortage right now in Seattle, what we've been dealing with is a concrete strike since December.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. And what does that mean? That means all commercial projects, large commercial projects from a concrete standpoint, has come to a screeching halt. So on the midsize, where we're operating, we're strategically working with owner operators of concrete trucks to be able to service our projects and our needs, which albeit comes at a cost, right? It's probably about a 15% increase cost on flat work, which, you know, on a 6-unit townhome is going to be about maybe $15,000 increase on cost. Not terrible, but absolutely something that, you know, we don't necessarily want to be taking.
$15,000.
But if you consider it from a money cost perspective, right? If we couldn't be pouring, last time people were pouring was back in December. And so, you know, as of right now, that's what, 2 months ago, and there's still no end in sight. So what the concrete strike is, the concrete workers are unionized here up in Seattle. The large firms are, the large concrete producers and deliverers and operators are unionized, which is great. But right now management and labor are in a dispute, and from the market's perspective, we're suffering. And so we're working with small owner operators to continue our projects forward. Once we get the concrete strike resolved, what'll end up happening is a large backlog of getting through those big commercial projects. And so we do have a long tail, probably 3 to 6 months after whenever that period, after that agreement is finished.
Interesting. So that's a good example, or I would say maybe a microcosm, but in the macro, you know, you have other trades that are involved. I would imagine that your costs of various other trades have gone up as well. Is it
right,
comparable in terms of, you know, 15%? Is it more or less?
No, I would say it's on par. You know, it's probably at or around the 10% increase on a true, like an apples to apples labor cost. Right. I would say 10% cost inflation on labor costs is absolutely what we're seeing right now. And what do we do with that? Right. On continued projects, I'll talk about current and continue in future projects. Future projects we're underwriting at that higher cost. Current projects, what are we doing? Thankfully, we have a couple different ways. We have a couple guaranteed max price. So lump sum contracts where, you know, we went into this knowing full well what the price would be with our developer. And, you know, unfortunately, it's some win, some lose in those contracts. And so, you know, it's going to be at the strength of the relationship between the general and the sub to be able to work through those cost increases.
Okay. So to go back to the timeline of one of these deals, I believe we've gotten up to the point where you're raising capital from investors. Once you get the capital in parallel, you know, what are you doing with the general contractor? And, you know, I would assume there's probably more permitting that needs to happen even after the lot itself is all ready to go. So what happens then?
Let's sure. Keep
pushing forward.
Yeah, good question. So concurrently with the investor side, we're also getting our master services, our contractor services agreement all ticked and tied and getting all of that negotiated. You know, a lot of that really just boils down to cost. So, you know, terms are pretty standard across the board from a development standpoint, you know, net 30, from a payment perspective, you know, how we work with change orders, costs, et cetera, communication plans, et cetera, kind of all standard terms, but, you know, really comes down to the cost. And so, you know, a lot of what the developer is going to be doing is going out, getting hard bids from their subcontractors, which typically, you know, depending on the size and the scope of the project, is about a 2 to 3 week process. So working with them on that concurrently with the contract terms. So that way, ideally within at the end of 4 weeks, we've got our capital raise from our investors, our contractor services agreement all finalized, signed off on, and we're working through any kind of title exemptions or any complexities outside of that and within the purchase and sale agreement.
Okay. So at that point, when do we finally get to, you know, somebody brings out a shovel and sticks that shovel in the ground? How close
day are two. We? So yeah, no. So good question. So day two is, you know, that's how I always phrase it, right? When we're meeting with developers, when we're meeting with investors is, you know, that's why right now we're really only hyper-focused on those permit-ready entitled projects to where day two, we have mobilized out the excavator and we are digging. And really truly that is the way that it works, because we're closing, our closing is contingent on seller pulling and issuing those permits, getting them ready, having those meetings with the architects on the front end, and getting our pre-construction meetings with the city all done prior to closing, right? There's a period between feasibility and closing where we do all of that stuff, right? Where it's, okay, our money's gone hard, and we know that we're going forward with this project, barring any kind of catastrophic event. So we're holding those pre-construction meetings. We're getting the permits pulled. We're getting everything done. So that way, again, the goal is day two to have excavators out there digging and moving earth.
So
and we do that so that way, you know, we can hit those month 10 and four, between 10 and 14 timelines.
Okay. So day one being the day that you actually close on the property, right? And day two,
right,
moving forward.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. So now we're on day two. Hopefully you're not skipping too many steps around here. Day two, property's getting built. You know, what are you in management mode? How, you know, assume there's probably some level of communication with your investors. What are you doing until you get, you know, until the property's done, right? What are you up to?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So we operate with the developer in the sense that we're working with them, understanding what are their obstacles, what's going on with them. And so that way we're able to effectively communicate back to our investors, construction timelines, as well as any kind of market updates. How does the market continue to appreciate, or is it softening? What's going on? And keeping all of that in the framework of, you know, the initial original investment, the original underwriting. So that way, again, you know, on these townhome developments, we're not paying out cash distributions during the life of the project because there's no cash from operations. So the way that it's teed up is, you know, hey, you've invested $100,000, assuming it's a $4 million exit. Now all of a sudden it's a $4.5 million exit. And how does that impact your initial investment from an underwriting perspective, right? Obviously, there may be cost increases. There may be longer hold times. There may be all of this. And so it's really showing and illustrating and communicating back to the investors as how are all of these changes impacting? Because, you know, all of our investors right now are full-time workers, full-time day job. We've got doctors, lawyers. We've got retirees where, you know, they don't necessarily want to, I'll actually say they don't actually want to, you know, be managing and working with these with the contractors and the lenders and all that kind of stuff. They want a quick, simple, succinct communication that says how their investment is performing. And that's what we give them. And not only is it the communication, but it's also holding the developers accountable for timelines, for budget, working with them, working with any kind of municipality and or utility company, which, by the way, I've learned that the most difficult part of construction is not the construction. It's working with the municipalities and the utility companies because it's out of our control, right? With subcontractors, that's within our control. With our crews and our builders, it's within our control. But when you bring in municipalities like the city or the county or Department of Transportation or the utility companies, those are all external. All we're doing is making their jobs more difficult. And so they see it as an adversarial relationship. And so our job as the management company is to mend those relationships, is to make it an easy process between our developer, ourselves, our investors, and those municipalities and the utility companies.
Nice. Yeah, that can really throw a wrench into the works, I can imagine, if a municipality decides they want to, you know, put a pause on things. So, okay, pushing forward, the property's getting built. You're coming close to, you know, it's going to be completed. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what timeline that is to complete the property in this case, but where do you go from there? I mean, there's the build to rent models fairly popular right now. Yep. There's obviously the MLS is insane. So you're probably not going to lose by selling it to a retail buyer. What are you looking at in terms of exit strategy at the end?
Good question. So we always phrase it as we've got those exact two, and typically the third of sell some, hold some at a low leverage permanent debt position. But the two primary strategies are the build to rent and the build to sell. And the chief, I would say, determinant of what strategy, what lever we pull is based on the temperature of the market at the time. Are things selling for, and this is a real number, $500,000 over asking? Or I think Bellevue may hold one of the records of over $1 million over asking.
That's insane.
It is insane. So it depends on the temperature of the market. Absolutely. Right. Or can we perform, outperform our underwriting to a 10 to 15 to 20% degree, or are we holding true to underwriting based on current market conditions? And so a lot of our investors, you know, are appreciative of our approach in that aspect because, you know, at the beginning of the project, especially in a market that continues to appreciate like Seattle has and like the rest of the nation has, you know, you can certainly appreciate the amount of gain that you get above the original underwriting in today's market. And so, you know, really it goes back to what are things selling for at the time? Is there a bidding war? Are there above asking offers, et cetera.
Okay. Awesome. Well, you know, it seems like this market has been very good to real estate developers even with all of the problems, you still have a very strong market on the back end to sell into, which is really what you need. Now, one question I want to ask here before we move on to the three questions I ask every guest at the end of the show, it's really about going into these deals adequately capitalized. I would, you know, imagine there's a bit of a temptation to kind of manage the amount of money that you raise because, hey, the more money that we raise, ultimately we get less of a return on that money. If we have too much sitting in the bank, then that impacts our returns on a percentage standpoint. So how do you manage that mentally? You want to have enough money. You never want to have to go back and say, hey, I need more money.
Typical.
Right. How do you balance that?
Sure. Good question. So yeah, first off, proud to say that we have not yet had a capital call.
Good.
That's fantastic. And nor do we plan on it based on, again, conservative underwriting. You know, it's a tough call, right? What's the balance? Do you want, well, first off, I'll say we don't want a capital call. So we will always over raise. Now, what does that do? Obviously, to your point, our cash on cash, our IRR typically would be skewed downwards, but you know, in a market where costs continue to go up, we're going to continue to do that, right? And so typically we'll raise 10 to 15%, which, you know, would calculate out to be $100,000 to maybe $150,000 more for within the operating account in order to cover any kind of cost like that. Luckily, we haven't had any of those. So it's operating account just sits full. But again, we've got that opportunity. We've got that option to pull that lever if we need be, cover the costs to continue on the construction.
Yeah, you'd really rather have that money sitting there waiting, doing nothing than have to go get it in a hurry.
100%.
Yeah. Wow. Well, awesome. Really appreciate you walking us through that strategy here today. Right now, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsor.
The first step to growing your wealth is tracking your wealth, income, spending, and everything else about your finances. You can start tracking your wealth for free and get 6 free months of wealth advisory with Personal Capital by going to escapingwallstreet.com and using our link. Create your free account today and automate the way you track your money. Personal Capital is my preferred way to track my finances, and now we're making that available for listeners. Terms and conditions apply. See the Personal Capital website for details. Once again, to get the offer, go to escapingwallstreet.com and use our link. Back to the show.
All right, Carl, I've got 3 questions I ask every guest on the show. Are you ready?
Yes.
Great. First one, what is the best investment you ever made other than in your education?
That's a tough one. I I would put it as, and I hope this isn't too cliche or existential, but I would put it in the relationships. Investing in relationships and investing in time in others is absolutely something that early in my career, I took advantage of and did not do as well as I intend to do now and continue to do. You know, really what I like to do is sit down, understand somebody, what makes them passionate, what are their life goals, and how can I help, if I can help, helping them to achieve that goal. Maybe it's making a connection to somebody that can, but it's I'm going to do what I can to help them reach that goal. Whether it's climbing a mountain, I can help with that. Or if it's creating wealth through passive investing, we can help with that. You know, again, my intent and what I like about investing in relationships and investing others is the joy that it brings in seeing others reach their goals. Again, whether it's monetary, existential, or whether it's something else that really, you know, that I can see that they're passionate about, that their gears are turning and that I can help with.
Nice. Love that. Well, we had the best investment. Now we go to the other side of that coin, the worst investment. What is the worst investment you ever made?
I would put it not within a real estate frame of mind. I would put it actually, financially speaking, I would put it in the sense that, you know, when I started on investing a couple decades ago, is investing in things that I did not understand. So ETFs, mutual funds, where I didn't do a thorough portfolio analysis, and looked at who are the different companies that make up that mutual fund, who are the owners and who is the leadership of those teams that compromise those companies, right? I looked at historical trends and assumed that future performance would be based on historical data. Mm-hmm. And now I ended up doing, you know, not bad, but looking at it, it was far riskier than anything I've done from an investment perspective. Because again, I didn't know anybody who was making me that money. All I did was assume that past performance would continue. And so, you know, the takeaway there is understand who you're investing in, understand who you're investing with, do your due diligence, and understand how, again, what the business plan is, what the communication plan is, and how your money is going to stay safe and grow.
Love it. My favorite question here at the end of the show is, what is the most important lesson you've learned in business and investing?
So I would break that up into two, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
From a business perspective, what I've learned running this business is the most important is building a roadmap of priorities and influencing others, my employees, my partner, our stakeholders within the industry, and getting those priorities and focusing our attention on those priorities, right? And so it's, again, building out that roadmap, taking down those priorities while also being nimble enough to be flexible and take on different priorities should they come up.
Nice.
And from an investing standpoint, I think the most important part of investing is, I go back to due diligence, is know what you're getting into, right? Either from an investment standpoint or from a sponsor, a general partner standpoint, do your due diligence, know what you're getting into. And again, just do it, do as much homework as possible. You know, sure, you may miss an opportunity, whether, you know, it's an investment, whether it's a general partner, whatever it happens to be, but you can't do enough due diligence. You know, what I like about operating in the commercial multifamily space is sellers and brokers tend to know that we need to be able to do due diligence, right? So we're able to get sizable feasibility inspection periods without having to negotiate too much. Now, in the single family space, you have to, like, it's incredibly competitive in the single family space, where you're waiving every single contingency. Your money is going hard. You're putting your firstborn down as hard automatically from day one, and you're closing in 14 days cash. And if you don't, well, there goes your firstborn and your earnest money. But, you know, again, what I like about the commercial multifamily space is we're able to perform that due diligence. And if for some reason, one reason or another, we're not giving that option, then it's not the right buy for us, because we're not going into an investment opportunity that we don't get to perform, you know, our full list of is the title right? Is the site right? Are the permits and plans right? Or are construction plans and costs right, et cetera? So I'd say by far due diligence is certainly the most important part of investing that I found.
Love it. Well, Carl, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for all the lessons. If folks want to reach out, if they want to get in touch with you, they want to, you know, talk with you more about any of this, these topics we've discussed today, where can they track you down?
Sure. So two spots, aurorasinvestmentgroup.com. That's aurorasinvestmentgroup.com. Or you can reach out to me directly, carl@aurorasinvestmentgroup.com. We are on LinkedIn as well as Instagram and Facebook.
Great. Well, thank you once again for joining us today. To everybody out there, thank you for tuning in. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars if you don't mind, you guys. I appreciate that so, so much. That helps other people learn about the show because that helps us rank higher in the Apple Podcast ecosystem. And I'm always honest with you guys. That gives me a nice little warm and fuzzy feeling because I get to see that you're engaging with the content and you're escaping the Wall Street casino along with us. If you know anyone who could use a little bit more passive wealth in their lives, please share the show with them and bring them into the tribe. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you on the next one. Bye-bye.